Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 25, delivered on November 27, 2018. The title of this lecture is Cash Flow Analysis.
Today,
cash flow analysis, which is the subject of Chapter 12. It's material I've already covered, so I'm not going to have you do the homework in it, because I've pretty much covered the whole subject already, and it's time for you to start getting ready for that doomsday thing we call a final exam next week. I'll spend all day on Thursday answering questions about it. Yeah.
It's next week or the week after?
The week after. Is it the week after? Yeah, that's right. It's the week after. Okay. I've got one extra week here. Okay. Which I'm glad for, because I've got some final material to cover with you, a few special topics. You'll probably have a surprise quiz on Thursday of this week, and so be surprised by it, okay? Act shocked. Oh, my God, it's a quiz. But other than that, and then on Thursday will be a special topic, and so will Thursday. Our Thursday of next week will be the review for the final exam. Yeah, I'm a week ahead of myself. Let's have a quick look at the numbers here. As you can see, the day is setting up fairly, not really strong down, but it's enough of a downstroke to be noticeable, with the Standard & Poor's and the Dow and the NASDAQ all showing weakness. Of course, the NASDAQ is showing the strongest weakness, about half a percent down, walking into the morning session. So it's not a great day. And now a quick look at the Treasury yield curve. On the 2-3 year, you can see that we are now at 2 basis points. That's the closest it's been. 2 basis points spread. It's getting very close to inversion. Just 2 more points and we've got it. And then we'll have the recession within about 6 months of that. About time for you guys to be out there trying to get an internship and everything like that. Confidence in the markets has eroded, and it's probably going to take one more really dramatic event to tip the markets over into a major, major correction. But that's not going to happen today or even next week, probably. However, the yield curve, if it does invert on the 2-3, that will be a sort of a shocker to the markets. The markets will react if the inversion happens. So keep an eye on that as it closes. The gap may make it to 1 basis point today, and then it's probably going to float for a few days, maybe even a week. But once it inverts, then all of a sudden all the traders are going to get all kinds of excited there, because there is a real inversion of the yield curve. And it's a close inversion, too, at the 2-3. That's kind of a little bit surprising. Now, if you also look something else interesting here, 3-5 has a 4 basis point spread. Now, that means that the 3-5 on a 1-year basis is about 2 basis points spread as well. So you've got 2 places now where an inversion is trying to occur. That should worry any market trader, because now we have 2 places, 2 chances for an inversion to happen at the 2-3 and at the 3-5. So we might want to be a little concerned now, because we're going to get the signal for the recession within a few weeks. And the market will get all kinds of excited about that as well. As far as other news, that economic news is concerned, not really that much that's going on right now. So just keep that in mind, though, that there's some interesting news coming up. Now, Cash flow analysis, I do want to bring up one last time. And I've written this equation before. We in finance do not care about profit. The accounting, big thing. Earnings for this quarter were. Earnings for the year were. Profit, it means nothing in actual financial analysis. And companies that focus on profit do so at their own peril. I've mentioned several companies that are well known that got all kinds of excited for years and years, keeping their eye on the profit, and they, in some cases, they actually became bankrupt, or they nearly became bankrupt. I told you the story of Caterpillar that was told by one of their financial officers, a former student of mine from some years back. She said that they were focused on profit for many, many years, and as they were, the company was dying because the cash flow wasn't there. You could show a profit every year, but if you cannot pay bills with cash, you are eventually going to go into bankruptcy. You will begin to see the necessity of cutting operations. We don't have the money for that. Well, we made a profit, but we still don't have the money for that. Well, our retained earnings, we got lots of retained earnings. Show me where we can write a check from retained earnings for what's going on, for what we have to pay. Well, there's no such checking account. Okay. So apparently, this whole thing with net income and profit and earnings, something is really wrong there. In finance, we care only about free cash flow. Free cash flow is revenue minus costs. Now, in here, like I said, usually these days, depreciation is tucked away and hidden somewhere in the net income statement. They don't break out depreciation, but I'll put it here anyway because we'll need to have it back in a while. But usually the depreciation is buried here in the costs of the firm on that financial statement, in the operating costs, which is kind of funny too because when they call it operating costs, depreciation doesn't even exist. It's not operating in any way, shape, or form. However, it does present a tax shield. This thing right here, if you were to look at this, oh, I should bring in something else here too. Minus interest expense. Because now I'm doing it the full way. This is leveraged free cash flow. In other words, all of these costs. Now, interest expense is very real. I'm going to write something over here. Depreciation times the company's marginal tax rate is a tax is what we call the tax shield from depreciation. It is what you save in taxes when you count depreciation. It's how much you save. So even though depreciation isn't a real thing, excuse me, let me have some more of this Jack or this coffee. Board's blurry. Oh, okay. So too is interest expense. Times the marginal tax bracket of the firm. That's a tax shield too. These are shields that protect income from being claimed by Uncle Sugar. So the one actually doesn't even exist. Depreciation, you don't write a check to depreciation. However, it does have the effect of saving money for the company. Depreciation times the marginal tax rate of the firm. And also the interest expense times the marginal tax rate of the firm protects the firm from taxes. So whatever you pay in interest, you don't pay the government in taxes. This is true of individual taxes as well. When you borrow for a home, I should say for home equity loans, when you borrow for a home, that tax, the interest you pay on it, you get to deduct that from your tax on your tax form. Now, for interestingly enough, for lower class people, for lower income people, there are two things that go on. Notice that the higher the tax bracket of the borrower, the more significant this tax shield is. So in other words, someone in a 15% tax bracket does not benefit as much from this tax shield as someone who would be in a 30% tax bracket. But there's also another thing that's odd about taxes as well. Sir, do you file file taxes?
Yeah.
You do. Do you use Form 1040 EZ?
No.
Oh, you don't?
Nope.
Ooh. He's a little unusual. Well, because most people, especially when you're lower income, you don't deduct. You don't do the deductions. You don't file a 1040. You file a Form 1040 EZ, where all you do is take the standard deduction. So even if you owned a home, it might not be the case that you would even take advantage of the interest expense tax shield. You would just fill out a 1040 EZ because it's faster, easier, and quicker for you to do it. And you probably can't afford to go to a tax place to get your taxes done. So you're going to file a Form 1040 EZ or maybe a 1040A or something like that, and you're not going to take advantage of the interest expense shield on a home mortgage anyway. Even if you own a home, you wouldn't do it. So in other words, someone who wants, do you like doing your taxes?
I love it.
Oh, dear God. What's your major?
No.
Okay. See, most people, when I have to file my taxes for my corporation, it's always this thing. You know, I've got some very nice kitchen knives, and I can kill myself very easily. Or I could sit down and do my taxes. And literally, I mean, if most people just want to get it over with, fill out a 1040 EZ, and be done with it. However, if you're a very wealthy person, you're a very wealthy person. You just have your accountant handle it. Ha, 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 handle it. And you don't even have to worry about it. So they'll fill out the whole nine yards and take the interest expense on the home you bought on a mortgage. So there's two things. And with corporations, quite honestly, if there were a way to do it, when I fill out my corporate taxes and I have to file for the interest expense, if I could find a way to do it, I wouldn't even try to work out that deduction on interest expense and show the form you get from the bank and all that kind of crap. I would just ignore it and move on and just pay the taxes and not worry about it instead of panicking and wondering where all the forms are and all that. But anyway, this thing right here, this mess right here, revenue minus cost minus depreciation minus interest expense times 1 minus T on your income statement is earnings before taxes, EBT. That's your EBT. So we can always start free cash flow. Well, I shouldn't say that. We can nominally start free cash flow analysis by just going to the accounting information and grabbing that earnings before taxes line. Or actually, we could even just grab the net income line. There's a slight difference here, and I'm going to put a little X through this. I mean, there's a little bit of a difference, but usually that's net income. That's usually net income. I've got to be a little careful on that, but I mean, you'll see me in a class like this get really sloppy. If you take my next class, you'll see me get a little bit tighter in 341. But I'll just grab the net income line quite frequently to get this done. Then comes the next fun. We have to add back the depreciation. Now, you usually are not going to see that on modern financial statements in the income statement. You're going to have to go over to the statement of cash flows to find the depreciation and amortization. It's hidden here. So, then come the big ones. You have to take away your capital expenditures. And you take away your change in net working capital. Net working capital. Okay, first of all, net working capital is current assets minus current liabilities. And the change in net working capital is the net working capital for the current period minus the net working capital for the previous period. Now, this should cover any money that has been raised through issues of debt and equity. It should. So in other words, if I were to raise money by selling stock, that should show up in cash. If I raised money through selling debt, that should show up in cash. Or it should show up in capital expenditures if I spend the money right away. Like with Netflix, you'll see that they raised a pile of money with debt. Their cash ballooned, but not as much as the money they raised in the debt. The remainder of it went right into capital expenditures. So theoretically, this covers it. This is free cash flow. This is the money that's left at the end of the day. This is what you are aiming at in a corporation. Notwithstanding what they might tell you otherwise in corporations. Now, this takes us around, back clear around, to capital structure. We need money in a company. The question is, how do we bring that money to the table? And as I said, there are two ways to do that, broadly speaking. There's equity, and there is debt. Equity has two large flavors. There is the equity that is internally generated. In other words, what you earn from selling your product or your service. At the bottom of the financial statement, I'm going to put this here, and it's really not exactly right. Net income. That's the money you earn. That belongs to the shareholders. You've paid your bills in a timely manner. What remains is available for you to use for projects. Okay, you paid the bills. the bills that are due, bills, bonds, and notes, I should say, that are due. You've paid the dividends, if you have a dividend. What's left, you can use for capital projects. Now, you're going to run out of that if you're an aggressive company in an aggressive period of growth. You might not if you're not an aggressive company. But if you run out of this, there's another equity. You can bring in new shareholders, externally generated. You notice that I'm filling in, I did this before, and now I'm beginning to fill in some of the meat of it. And I'll have a demonstration here because this is important, what we're about to talk about. Externally generated is you sell stock. Now that could be preferred stock or common stock, doesn't matter. Sell preferred, sell common. And there are some weird hybrid instruments, too. And that's one of the special topics next week. Financing, let me give you a hint real quick, a little window. There were companies that I was helping to raise capital. They wanted to sell stock to raise money. The problem was that the market just was not going to support. If they wanted to sell 1 million shares of stock to raise a million, let's say they wanted to sell 100,000 shares of stock. They wanted to do 100,000 common share offering. To raise $1 million, which was what they needed. So, obviously, that'd be $10 per share. It actually would probably have to be more than that because I was going to take out my fee. My chain of money people were going to take out, their brokers were going to take out money. So it's probably going to be closer to like $12 a share if the company wanted to net $1 million. And the market just was for these little tiny companies that were speculative. Some of them had technologies that actually were good, but they were just too far ahead of their time to attract a lot of investors. The reality was, back in the 1990s, some of the stuff that you hear about today that's, oh yeah, this is on the market, there were little companies that had these ideas back then in the 80s and 90s. It just was that there was no one who believed in it enough to pay $10, $12 a share for the risk of taking on a company like this. And quite honestly, they were right. These companies were too far ahead, so there was no way that you were going to get, you know, buyers to adopt these kinds of products. So anyway, was there any way that I could get them their money this way? Or should I sell a lot more stock? Well, the more stock that I put out there, okay, let's do 200,000. The market's just not going to have a belly for that. I'm going to have a hard enough time selling 100,000 shares. So sometimes I would do a trick called a unit offering. A unit offering works like this. I would put the market out there, one unit, at $12 per unit. Now here's how it worked, was that the unit would comprise one share common plus one warrant. And I'd make it detachable. I'll explain that in a minute. One detachable warrant striking at $14 per share. What that means, now, first of all, a detachable warrant means that the warrant itself can be detached from the share of common stock and traded on its own as its own security. So it could have its own market, or it could be kept by the buyer of the unit. This means that if the stock price, let's say, starts to go up, let's say it goes up to $15, $16, $17, the buyer of the unit has his share of common stock, but he also has the right, not the obligation, but he has the right to buy another share at $14 a share. So in other words, the warrant would be worthless as long as the stock stayed below $14 a share. But if the stock price started to boost up, then suddenly the warrant becomes live. And it's in the money, as we would say. And then whoever has the warrant, either the original unit buyer or whoever bought the warrant for a few bucks from the buyer, can buy the share of stock, another share of stock of this company, at $14. So like if the stock price went up to $18, well, there's someone who can buy the stock at $14 a share and then, of course, sell it for $18 right away and make a profit of $4. One of the reasons this was attractive was that brokers would see that $14 and they would actively try to make a market in the stock to make the price go up so that they would then buy these warrants below $14 when they were below, when the stock price was down there at $10, $12, $14, $13. And then they would have these warrants that they could exercise if they pushed the stock price up enough to make the warrants come to life. So there's that little odd twist in there, and I wanted to bring that up to you, that it's a lot more complicated markets are than you might think sometimes. But anyway, now debt. Debt is obviously debt, and it just sits there. There are different kinds of debt, you know, your bills, your notes, your bonds. You can go long, you can go short, but debt tends to be cheaper than equity. It is cheaper than equity until a company takes on so much debt that the lenders start jacking up the interest rate on it. Then suddenly it gets a little bit more problematic. Interestingly enough, General Electric, GE, has recently been in so much trouble that its debt was selling way, way below par, and which means that if GE wanted to raise more money, it would have to offer ridiculously high interest rates to get that money. So in other words, there's a point where a company borrows so much debt that markets begin to get scared that they're going to default, and they start jacking up the interest rate to represent the additional risk. So there's where we get to that thing that I drew the last time. Your weighted average cost of capital. The percent of debt I put on this axis, which is 100% minus the percent of equity. Now, in an ideal world, if this is the cost of equity, R sub E, if you use 0% debt, then your weighted average cost of capital is going to be the cost of equity, which is very high. As you take on more debt, debt is cheaper than equity, at least at first, but there comes a point where the company has taken on so much debt that the lenders start jacking up the interest rates they want, and suddenly the weighted average cost of capital curve starts to take a serious turn. As a matter of fact, the WACC at 100% debt, you could have an insanely high weighted average cost of capital. If a company is 100% leveraged, it could be paying more for its capital than if it used pure equity. This brings us to this point right here. The combination of debt and equity that minimizes weighted average cost of capital. We call this the optimal capital structure. It's a combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. First, finding it is part of long ago, it was just feeling in the dark. Just, okay, we're borrowing money and we're having less ownership interest, more borrowed money. Geez, the cost of our debt, our weighted average cost of capital is going up. So in other words, back in the old days, you would have companies just feeling around, trying to find out where the sweet spot between debt and equity was. Now we can do it mathematically, the modern age, and we can actually calculate the place. The problem is that place moves around. And so you can't just say, well, we're at our the right debt-equity combination, and so we're good. Never worry about that again? Well, yeah. For one thing, interestingly enough, making money is going to throw your whack out of whack. Because as you make money and it goes into free cash flow, that means that you've got less, your percent of equity is going up, internally generated equity, and as you pay your debts off, your percent of debt is going down. So you can find a successful corporation over time can actually drift to the left on the weighted average cost of capital curve. And before it knows it, it's actually paying more for overall weighted average cost of capital is higher than it was a few years ago. Because they're making money, so internally generated equity is going up. They're paying off their debt, so their debt percent of debt is going down in the capital structure. So all of a sudden, surprise. The other hand, of course, is that a company like a Netflix, which is borrowing money like mad, it's just going crazy borrowing money. The question is, do they really understand that they're moving their capital structure further and further toward debt? Are they saying that we were not on our optimal capital structure? In other words, are they saying that they were somehow way back here and that they are actually borrowing money because they were way back here away from their optimal capital structure? Is that what they're saying? If it is, then the question is, how could they have been so irresponsible that they allowed themselves to be this far back away from their optimal capital structure? Let me say that again. Netflix is borrowing money like crazy. So they're logically, that must mean that they're aiming at an optimal capital structure that has a lot more debt as a percent of total assets. But if they're saying that, and if they've been borrowing money in round after round in huge quantities, that must mean that they were for years back here. How could they have allowed themselves to do that? How could they have allowed the company to get into that much trouble as far as weighted average cost of capital? Right now, Netflix, as of this last round, they're 65% debt, 35% equity. Okay? They've borrowed so much that they are now a 65% leveraged company. That's a pretty steep leverage. So they're saying that this must be their optimal capital structure. Otherwise, they're saying, we're so stupid that we decided that we are going to do this right here. We're just going to move up our way away from the optimal capital structure, just borrow money Just borrow money. Is that what they're saying? We don't care about optimal capital structure. We're just going to borrow money. Likely as not, they're not quite as crazy as it seems. One thing is that Netflix makes large amounts of free cash flow. It is quite possible that they made so much money over the past 5 years that their internally generated equity had gone clear up to there, pushed them clear. That's one possibility. They just made so much money for so long, and now they're trying to correct what they've done by borrowing huge amounts of money to move themselves back to their optimal capital structure. That's a possibility. But there's another possibility, too. There's another possibility, too. And this is the one where Netflix said, we're borrowing all this money to put in content, to create new shows, to create new this, new that. And therein lies one of the most important parts of capital structure, maintaining it. And in order to show you this, I would ask my volunteers to join me here. I'm going to show you a simple example of a farmer who runs a little business. And the farmer's capital structure is 25% debt and 75% equity. Okay? Now, I have bankers available right now. Do I have an equity financer? Yes, see? An equity financer who will provide equity funds for this farmer. And I have a banker that is would be willing to provide debt. Now, if you will join me, my volunteers, here for just a minute. My volunteers are hiding. The farmer in question needs to buy two horses, and it's going to cost him $1 for these two horses. Shall we?
Do we have any lines? Or just...
No.
Do we have any?
What's my motivation? Yeah.
Here. What's my angle?
Yeah, your beard is almost thick enough. I don't need this, but we're okay. Now, you understand that this is very special. I don't just give this horse head to just anyone.
Oh, I understand.
Okay, I will.
Can you see out of
this? Sure, the eyes. This is the farmer. Oh, the horse wasn't supposed to. This farmer needs $1. So I'd like you to go over there to the bankers and the brokers. Now, what do you need?
I need $1.
Okay. Go ahead. Give him $1. No. Because you see, if he your equity, right?
Yes.
If you finance it all with equity, I am blacking out. It's so hot in this damn place. If he takes $1 in equity, he blows his capital structure right there. So what do you have to borrow? What do you have to get from the broker, the equity broker? Good. That will buy me. Now, what do you have to get from the debt?
25.
How much?
25.
No, that's right. That will buy this horse. And I use that term loosely, ma'am. So you need 25 cents from her. And what that does is it finances the entire amount, but it also
maintains the capital structure of the firm, of the farmer here. Because now he has his dollar financing, so he can buy us, and he has also remained at the exact same point he was on his weighted average cost of capital curve. This should illustrate, in no uncertain terms, the importance of maintaining optimal capital structure. There's only one last question. Why did it cost 75 cents for her and 25 cents for me? We have that 25 cents.
Because you're older?
You know why? Because I am a quarter horse. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.